Welcome to Morning Report Top Stories, a selection of news from Radio New Zealand National's Morning News Programme.
Hong Kong's most prominent activist, Joshua Wong, is behind bars after pleading guilty to charges related to last year's protests. He's facing up to 5 years in prison after he pleaded guilty to organising and taking part in protests outside a police station in June last year. Previously, Mr. Wong and his fellow activist Ivan Lam had entered not guilty pleas, but both men changed their minds at the last minute. In a tweet, Joshua Wong said, quote, "Compared to the 2,000 Hong Kongers prosecuted and the 12 Hong Kongers detained in China, the charges I face are minimal." Richard Kimber is our correspondent in Hong Kong, and he updated Morning Report's Lily Della Porta from outside the court last night.
Joshua Wong and his fellow activists Agnes Chow and Ivan Lam, all in their 20s, they will be sentenced on December the 2nd, that's next week. I'm just standing outside the courthouse waiting for the three to be formally taken into custody. The court case only lasted half of a day. In the end, it was going to be a six-day trial, but because they all pleaded guilty, they've already found that they're going to be remanded in custody and face sentencing on December the 2nd. The prosecution was explaining to the judge how they had been involved in many activities to try and encourage more people to join the protest and to make the protest even bigger. The defence, in contrast, trying to remind the judge how the reputation of these three activists is very high among some of their peers, and they had references from other key individuals in Hong Kong society suggesting that the penalties should be more lenient. It's not clear at the moment whether or not the court will adopt a tougher strategy on these three. Nevertheless, Joshua Wong saying, even before he went into the courtroom today, that he's fully expecting jail time. It's just not clear how long that jail time might be.
Why have they pleaded guilty? What's their strategy?
Agnes Chow actually pleaded guilty many weeks ago in advance of this trial beginning. Joshua Wong and Ivan Lam, both until last night, Hong Kong time, maintaining that they would deny all charges against them. They then, in a fairly dramatic twist, reversed that stance and announcing on social media that they planned, in fact, to plead guilty after further consultation with the lawyers. Joshua Wong alluded to this morning before he went into the courtroom and suggested that he's been advised that they will face a lesser punishment if they plead guilty to this charge than some potential charges they may face later on if they continue campaigning as vocally as they have been. So that seems to be the strategy. In Agnes Chow's case, she's never had any criminal conviction before, and so she stated at the time that she believed that by pleading guilty now, she may face a lesser punishment. Both Joshua Wong and Ivan Lam have been arrested and been jailed before.
What has the reaction been in Hong Kong so far?
So far, there's great disappointment from democracy activists that Joshua Wong in particular, such a well-known figure in the international movement to support Hong Kong, may end up being back in jail. He does have a significant amount of support, especially among young protesters here. There is, though, a section of Hong Kong society that does see Joshua Wong as a troublemaker, inciting other young people to follow his lead in campaigning so vigorously. And so they probably will not be so disappointed to see him potentially end up being sentenced with jail time on December the 2nd. But he has become something of a polarizing figure between the continued efforts among much of society here to rally against the government and the effects of this national security law that was imposed by Beijing back in July, and also some sections of society that really want Hong Kong to return to a pre-protest normal and get back on an economic footing that will allow it to recover from the effects of the coronavirus.
Where does this leave things now for the anti-government movement in Hong Kong?
There's certainly still a huge amount of frustration in society that will allow a sense of protest to continue, even if it's not street protest. But really, without figureheads such as Joshua Wong and without the entire pro-democracy lawmaker clan who have all resigned 10 days ago because of frustrations that they had with regards to other orders from Beijing, it's hard to see how the protest movement can continue with the same sense of determination and direction that it had at the end of last year. Should these three activists end up being jailed for a significant length of time, it then leaves big question marks about who the figureheads of this movement could be. Largely last year, during the protest movement, there was a huge amount of momentum that brought out many more moderately minded people onto the street to voice their frustrations. But since the implementation of the security law, there's been very little opportunity for that same thing to occur.
That's Hong Kong correspondent Richard Kimber speaking to Morning Report's Lily Della Porta. At least four inmates at Auckland's women's prison were gassed with multiple canisters of pepper spray while inside their cells in an approved tactic their lawyer says is risking lives. Two of the prisoners spent 4 months in a segregation unit where they had to lie face down on the ground, often with their heads beside the toilets, if they wanted to be fed. They sometimes went days without food if they refused to comply with what they saw as a humiliating ritual. One of the inmates became severely depressed and attempted suicide, but was resuscitated and returned to the segregation unit the next day in conditions likened to being kept like caged animals. The treatments come to light after three inmates were charged with burning prison property, and the court case over the arson revealed the conditions the women faced at New Zealand's largest women's prison. Investigative journalist Guyan Espiner reports.
After she lit a fire which caused $20,000 worth of damage to prison property in October last year, inmate Mihi Bassett was sent to D Wing, a segregation unit known as the Pound. Prisoners deemed a security risk usually spend 2 weeks there. Bassett was held for 4 months.
It was like going to war. They were hostile, we were hostile. So it was just the never-ending, repetitive cycle of ugly every day.
Her lawyer, Hannah Kim, is appalled at how her client was treated.
Prisoners being zoo animals and officers like zookeepers. It was very degrading.
In the Pound, this included having to perform what the prisoners saw as a humiliating ritual just to be fed.
The prisoner is told to get down on the ground, like their face on the floor, their legs up, their toes pointing in the air, and they have to do that before the food is served. And if they don't, or if they don't do it right away, prison officers will regard that as a refusal and refuse food.
Hannah Kim also represents inmate Karma Cripps, who's been Bassett's partner for 3 years. Cripps also spent 4 months in the Pound and says she had to undress in front of male guards and plead for basic hygiene items.
One of my clients, Karma, said in evidence that she had to show used sanitary product to be given a new one. That came from both female and male prison guards.
Hannah Kim says while that was degrading for the women, the practice of bombing them in their cells with pepper spray could have been life-threatening for Cripps, who has asthma.
My client had told me that it doesn't really matter where you stand in the room, you'll be bombed and you'll be suffocating and you won't be able to open your eyes and you will have trouble breathing.
Corrections officers put a hose under the cell door and deploy canisters of pepper spray in what's called a cell buster extraction, designed to get a non-compliant prisoner to vacate their cell. At least four women were subjected to the tactic, which is now part of separate court action for human rights violations. Mihi Bassett was traumatised by the conditions in D Wing. She tried to commit suicide in January and had to be resuscitated by prison staff. But Bassett and Cripps were both sent back to the Pound the next day.
And what shocked me more was that they put Karma into Mihi's old room, which is where Mihi tried to kill herself.
Corrections doesn't deny what happened to the women, but in court, the police prosecutor tried to show that Mihi Bassett brought the treatment on herself.
Did you become verbally aggressive towards staff?
Most times, yeah.
Using words similar to threatening to kick a staff member's head in?
Can't remember, but
possibly something
along those lines, yeah.
Corrections says there were about 65 incidents where Bassett, who's serving 10 years for her role in a home invasion, was violent or threatened violence to prison staff, and that she was subject to 42 disciplinary hearings. Corrections says the women were bombed with pepper spray in their cells because they'd activated the sprinklers, and after that happens, the inmates know they have to vacate the cells for safety reasons.
Did you refuse to relocate peacefully?
No, I didn't refuse to relocate peacefully. I just was scared from knowing what happened the day before. I was, hiding underneath the bed.
Monaco District Court Judge David McNaughton will decide early next year whether or not Mihi Bassett will get extra jail time for the arson, but made it clear he was concerned about the conditions in D Wing. Alison Fowley, the Deputy Prison Director at Auckland Women's Prison, says forcing the women to lie face down on the ground before they are fed is a security measure. Judge McNaughton asked whether that was over the top.
That looks pretty extreme as a security measure. Wasn't it just be asked to stand back against the wall, bar wall while the food is delivered through the hatch?
You're asking me to give an opinion on something that I wasn't involved in as the decision maker.
Judge McNaughton also asked Alison Fowley whether it was necessary to send six guards in riot gear to hose pepper spray into a cell to extract a prisoner.
That looks like an overwhelming use of force. Do you think justified in these circumstances?
The review's been completed and it's been assessed as being justified.
Corrections says it can't comment further because the case is still before the courts. Mo te hotaka o te ata, ko Gaia Nespana tēnei.
The Children's Commissioner has called for an end to the state care of Māori children and babies. It is the major recommendation from the second part of an inquiry into the removal of babies by the Children's Ministry, Oranga Tamariki. The Assistant Māori Commissioner for Children, Glenys Philip Barbara, says the government must now determine whether iwi and hapu can take on a transfer of power from Oranga Tamariki.
What we're asking for is for the government to recognise mana Māori by handing over the power to define, determine and decide what good looks like for tamariki Māori to Māori. I don't think we've had a better time in our history as a nation to realise this dream. I'm hopeful that government will step back and understand how important it is to share power as a treaty partner.
The report is part of a large-scale investigation into Oranga Tamariki, which found that Māori babies were five times more likely than non-Māori babies to be taken into care, with the urgent removal of Māori babies from their whānau doubling since 2010. In a statement, Oranga Tamariki Chief Executive Grania Moss said any further discussions were the government's responsibility. Well, Calvin Davis is the Minister for Children. He joins us now. Tēnā koe.
Morena.
Minister, if I could just ask you, with your corrections role hat on for a brief moment first, in relation to Guy and Espina's report there about the women's prison, some alarming details revealed there. What was your reaction to that?
Yeah, it is disturbing to hear, and because it is before the courts, it's limited in what I can say, but my expectation is that prisoners are looked after according to the Corrections Act, and I'll be asking officials for a briefing on this situation.
Yes, I mean, this isn't the first time Guyan has reported on issues from the women's prison. Is there a need for some further investigation?
Yeah, I think so. Like I said, it is disturbing to hear, and I'll be asking my officials for a briefing on what's going on.
Okay, let's go back to Oranga Tamariki. This is one of a number of reports on this agency. Will the government allow for Māori to run their own services when it comes to children in this regard? Is it time for a complete change?
Well, look, first of all, I welcome the release of the report from the Children's Commissioner, and I thank them for their considered recommendations. It is one of four reports that have come out recently, and also want to acknowledge the whānau, the midwives, the social workers and community organisations who have shared their stories. We have to be brave and admit where Oranga Tamariki have got things wrong and what needs to change, and working in partnership with Māori is what needs to happen. I support the overall direction of these recommendations. I think that if we move to a by Māori for Māori system, and we have to make sure that we get it right. I'm not into separatism. I think that the Crown can't absolve itself of its responsibility to make sure children grow up in safe and loving families. But certainly, I think that there is the general direction is a shift towards moving of power and resources towards Māori, and
okay. Not into separatism. So, do you have a philosophical opposition to the state giving control to Māori when it comes to babies and children in this regard?
I think that we need to look at the Te Tiriti partnership, and partnership means that the Crown cannot absolve itself of responsibility, its own responsibilities, but certainly I think we can move from what is essentially a European paradigm, Eurocentric paradigm, towards a more Māori way of doing things, and I'm certainly up for that conversation.
But what would that look like? Because the key point here is that it's Māori design it. So you have to you seem to be reluctant to really want to give over the power.
Well, that's what I said. If we're going to do this, we need to make sure we do it right and that any system is better than the one we had previously. And I'm right up for having the conversation about what that may look like, but we have to make sure that we do it properly. And there would need to be a shift of power and resources, but again, the Crown can't just wash its hands of its responsibility to make sure that babies, our children are looked after. And so we need to be working together in partnership, but certainly moving away from what is essentially a Eurocentric paradigm into a more Māori way of doing things.
The funding, though, I mean, it wouldn't be giving up power entirely, would it? If it would still be providing the funding. I'm just interested in where that line is drawn. So where could there be autonomy? I mean, at what point would you say the government lets Māori do what it wants to do in this area and where it doesn't? Is there a line there?
Well, that's what we have to work out. You know, like I say, whatever we do in the future has to be better than what we're doing now, and let's have that conversation. I'm right up for it. And, you know, my personal belief is that we need to move towards a Māori way of doing things. So what that looks like ultimately, it needs to be decided. And but, you know, the thing is that we're talking about it, and we certainly can't continue to do what we've always done. Like I said earlier, we have to put up our hands and say, admit where Oranga Tamariki has got things wrong and what needs to change. And working in partnership with Māori, in my opinion, is what needs to happen.
Is it possible that Oranga Tamariki, as it exists at the moment, could end? There could be something different?
Well, I think there's still a role for the Crown, but we need to work all those things out and have that conversation and make those plans, whatever future direction that we head in. You know, it's yet to be determined. But like I say, the Crown, I believe, needs to be there, but we also need to be moving away from a real Eurocentric way of...
But are you promising... Yeah, this is the issue. Are you giving an assurance that it won't just be more tinkering and incremental change? Because the report makes clear that trust and understanding are critical, and without the foundation, incremental improvements to the system are unlikely to lead to change. It's saying that the trust is gone after 30 years within Māori, that you can't just make more incremental changes. Can you give that assurance?
Well, I'm not going to make promises now, but I have been meeting with some of Oranga Tamariki's harshest critics, through to last week a group of Māori CEs who are quite supportive of Oranga Tamariki's, you know, what's been happening, as well as somebody who is basically saying, well, this is what the Crown, the government needs to do better, and this is what Māori need to do better. So there's a range of opinions across the Māori spectrum. We have to really work out together the direction that we're going to go to make sure that every child is raised in a safe and loving family.
When you talked earlier about a Māori way of doing things, can you shed some light on that for people who may not be familiar with Te Ao Māori and the way, a different way of thinking? Because colonisation, systemic racism is identified in this report as having been ingrained in the system, and there needs to be a change. What are those key changes in your mind?
Well, the first thing we have to do is make sure that the mana of the child, the parents, the whānau, the wairua whānau, hapū and iwi are maintained, that we work with manaakitanga, whanaungatanga, atawhai, to make sure that the best outcome is met, but we do it in a Māori way. The nuts and bolts of what happens if a child does need to be uplifted from their parents, you know, we'll work that out, but we certainly need to do it in a real Māori way.
And just to be clear, I just want to come back to this point. It is a philosophical opposition to a separate system. It's not about resources or politics here. You're saying that's something you believe the state should have a role in.
Look, I'm a direct descendant of a signatory of Te Tiriti o Waitangi, and that was a partnership. And, you know, that's why Māori, such as myself, have got into politics, to make sure that the system itself actually becomes more Māori-friendly rather than Māori having to adapt to the system as it is. So, you know, I just don't think that separatism has worked anywhere in the world. We have to work together in a partnership.
Calvin Davis, thank you very much for your time. The Minister for Children.
There are positive results from trials of a new COVID-19 vaccine. That's the third in as many weeks. Developed by Oxford University and AstraZeneca, the vaccine is 70% effective. That's less than the 90% plus effectiveness of the other two vaccines developed by Pfizer and Moderna. But the vaccine is cheap to produce and can be stored in fridges rather than at sub-Antarctic temperatures. Let's talk with Philippa Roxby, the BBC's health correspondent. Kia ora, good morning. Thank you for being with us today. I guess this is interesting. And can you explain to us why it is that the 70% effectiveness can also rise to around 90%?
Yeah, sure. Hi. Yeah. This is the 70% is a total of the whole trial of nearly 24,000 volunteers. But they actually did two different things during this trial. They tested half a dose, firstly, on some people and then gave them a standard second dose. And in that group, they've actually found the vaccine to be up to 90% effective. But when they gave two full doses of the vaccine, it was slightly lower at 62%. So what the scientists are saying they want to do now is follow what happened in that 90% effective group, giving that half full first dose and then a standard second dose. It sounds quite strange that the half dose seemed to work better than the two first full doses, but that seems to be what happened. So now what they're going to do is investigate why that happened. They don't really know, but it's possible that the immune system rejected the vaccine initially and then worked better after the second dose. But if they can follow that pattern and experiment and test on more people, then it might be up to 90% effective, which would be on a par with those other vaccines you mentioned.
And what
which is very encouraging news.
Yeah, and what is what are some of the other advantages to the Oxford vaccine?
Yeah, it's cheap. It relies on a tried and tested technology, which Oxford scientists have been working on for a number of years. It's a very traditional form of technology for combating viruses. Pfizer and Moderna, the two other companies which have created a vaccine, are relying on a more experimental technology, which hasn't been tested before. So as a result, the Oxford vaccine is cheaper. It probably costs around £3. Sorry, I'm using British pounds in this case. £3 a dose. Compared to maybe five times that amount for the other vaccines. And it, as you say, it can be stored at quite cool temperatures, just in a normal standard fridge, which is available in many different countries, low-income countries as well as middle-income countries. The other vaccines are much more difficult to store and, as a result, much more difficult to distribute. So that's a couple of advantages there. And large-scale manufacturing of the Oxford vaccine is already happening in numerous different countries. And one of the companies behind it, AstraZeneca, said they will do it on a not-for-profit basis for the developing world, which means that they will be able to roll out, well, they've committed to rolling out 3 billion doses of this vaccine next year.
Right. And what is the situation with older people or people who are at greater risk of becoming very ill with COVID-19? What does this vaccine give them?
This is showing promise in older age groups. In the phase two trial, which was the one that finished last week and we got the data for, it showed the same immune response in people in their 60s and 70s as in younger people. And that's very promising because sometimes we expect older people not to respond as well to vaccines. But in this case, they seem to respond extremely well. And that was found by the other vaccines as well. So it seems as if the issue of protecting older age groups isn't going to be an issue. And that's important because they're most at risk from illness from this virus. So it's very important to know that they are going to be well protected.
Thank you very much for the update and your time. That's Philippa Roxby there from the BBC. Hundreds of St John paramedics and ambulance staff are poised to walk off the job this week twice as the pay dispute between their union and St John drags on. More than a third of St John's paramedic and ambulance staff, it's around 1,000 workers, come under the First Union umbrella. Most of them plan to go on strike for 24 hours from 6 o'clock tomorrow morning, again on Saturday. Well, two unions have agreed to take St John's offer, while another, First Union, remains in discussion over the $58 million on the table. I spoke earlier to St John Deputy Chief Executive of Ambulance Operation, Dan Ors, who says First Union is striking over penal rates, that is the extra amount paid for working nights or weekend shifts.
The key discussion point is over the payment of penal rates and whether or not it's a 0.25 or 25% penal rate, which is what First Union has asked for, or a 0.15 or 15% penal rate, which is what St John has offered, which is in line with the findings of the independent pay review.
What's a penal rate?
So a penal rate is something which is paid in recognition of working nights and weekends, and it's paid to recognise the impact, the long-term impact on the health and well-being of ambulance officers.
Okay. The union says that the amount that they have asked for is within your funding to give. Is that possible?
So the amount of funding that is allocated to St John would enable us to pay a 0.25 penal, but it would only enable us to do that if we didn't also correct the base pay of ambulance personnel. So it's kind of one or the other. So we're not able to raise the base amount of ambulance personnel and also pay a premium penal rate, which is in excess of what was recommended to us by the independent review.
So the union say that you are not honouring key promises made last year by St John management. What's that about?
So we agreed to commission an independent pay review, which would enable a penal rate system consistent with the findings of that review. That independent review recommended a penal rate of 1.15 and an increased correction to base payment. So we're surprised that one of the three unions is striking based on that one sticking point, which we've already talked to, which is what they've asked to be reviewed by the employment court. So that's coming up for review. The discussion between the 1.15 and the 1.25 is going to be heard next year. And if the employment court finds that a rate of 1.25 must be paid, then St John, of course, will honour that.
What sort of contingency plans have you put in place so that the public are going to be safe should they require an ambulance on either Wednesday or Saturday?
Yeah, thank you. So we have a comprehensive plan which ensures that the public will be safe. So firstly, we've managed to fill the majority of our rosters, which is really good. The striking union represents around about 37% of our paid personnel and none of our volunteers. And we have people in other roles that aren't predominantly frontline who also hold ambulance qualifications.
Dan Orr is from St John. We can talk now with Sarah Stone, First Union's National Ambulance Coordinator. Kia ora.
Kia ora.
So you were listening there to what St John had to say. Can you explain why it is that you're taking this strike action?
Yeah, well, unfortunately, here we are again in protracted bargaining with St John. And what we're faced with is that they only applied for funding that would result in workers getting a wage cut in this round, and that where they are receiving full funding, they're cutting pay to those roles anyway.
Well, so, I'm sorry to interrupt, but there are a couple of things that they say that's not the case. You know, for example, St John is saying there's not going to be any staff in the position where they're having a pay cut. They're saying that the deal that you're being offered, First Union members are being offered, is the same as the deal that's been put to two other unions. Is that not the case?
We're all under the same collective agreement, but what we discovered during bargaining was that St John made a written plan to work with this yellow union to break the and cause divide in the membership. And what they said was, let's delay settling. This is written down in their plan, and Peter Bradley's denied it, but the documents are out all over the weekend, is that let's delay settling with First Union and work with these yellow unions to break the workforce. And we've come back to St John, given the funding situation and the way it is, because they didn't apply for the funding. The minister earlier said he would have preferred that previous commitments were honoured. And he's talking about the shift pay. And so we're saying that, OK, we've come back with a cost-neutral alternative so that those workers who are losing out because of the reneging on the shift pay, we come back with a cost-neutral alternative. And last night, St John turned that down at 8:30 at night.
What's a yellow union?
It's a union that's not really going to fight with management. It's a union, in this case, that contacted St John before the bargaining began to say to them, this is how you can get out of paying the shift pay. And so not only our workers have been missing out on the time and a quarter, but their own members are now missing out on the time and a quarter. And that's what the documents show.
So for you, the sticking points are pretty significant. It sounds like you're quite far apart. Sounds like you're pretty unhappy with the other unions involved here. What's next?
Well, we have got a solution and we've put that to St John, and it's a cost neutral solution. But what we want is for Peter Bradley to stand down. He's lied on television and said that there wasn't a plan, and you'll see in writing that the documents dispute that. We want an independent, we want a commissioner to come in and run the service so that it's safe for the workers there and it's also safe for New Zealand. And I think that what New Zealand needs to understand is that Saturday night there were ambulances down all over New Zealand because they cannot run this service safely. And that's what the Martin Jenkins report says.
Okay,
it says they can't stick to their budget.
Sarah Stone, thank you very much. From First Unions, she's the National Ambulance Coordinator there. And of course, we must emphasise that the views she's expressed there are her views and not those of RNZ.
You've been listening to Morning Report Top Stories from RadioNZ.co.nz.